In our Sunday evenings, we are involved in a study of the Bible book by book, and we have come this time to the study of the book of Esther, a rather unknown and unfamiliar section of the Bible, but I'd like you to turn to it if you will. If you don't have a Bible, you really will be lost because we are in a sort of a chapter-by-chapter study of this book. Obviously, it bears the name of a woman as its title, like the book of Ruth. And since it does, some general things ought to be said about women. I realize in doing so, I'm treading on thin ice because that is one of the controversial subjects. It used to be rather simple to be a woman. You were simply born a girl, and the result was you were dressed in pink and you wore little white lacy things, and you played with dolls and little toy stoves and washing machines. And as soon as you got interested in fellas, you looked for a man, you married him, and then you made him happy the rest of your life. It is not that way now by any stretch of the imagination. As a matter of fact, it's much easier to be a guy. Since I have two of both in our family, I can assure you it's far less complicated to raise a fella than it is a girl. Guys just sort of jerk themselves up and buy a car and wing it for the rest of their lives, but not girls. Gene Hendricks has written an awfully good book entitled A Woman for All Seasons, and in it she writes some good stuff. She says there were, in the past, cultural pigeonholes. And with few exceptions, society placed girls there with or without their consent. You may have pouted, scratched, pounded, and screamed at the nutrition and needlework routine, but that was your label, whether you liked it or not. Present-day pigeonhole painters have been offering variations of girl places in the human nest. For several decades, dark clouds of questions about women have been grown more threatening, like descending tornado funnels. Some of these dilemmas have pierced our routine of living, writes Hendricks. The feminist movement has marched into our lives and turned our homes inside out and propelled women into such male sanctuaries as the executive boardroom, police patrol cars, and even the role of the astronaut. Zooming in the opposite direction, a small book called Total Woman reached unprecedented heights of prominence by advising wives simply to submit to their husbands. Debaters, lecturers, playwrights have tendered a literary smorgasbord to delight every taste on the subject of the female. Whether it's housework or soccer now, we all must learn to do it together. If we ever get turned down for a job because of our brand of hormones, it's a federal offense. Then she adds, all these no-nos and go-gos have created a monstrous complex of confusion, especially for women. And it's true. Women are remarkable creatures, in spite of our complex times. I read recently of a woman who was filling out an application for a job, and she came to the one-word question, age, and she answered, nuclear. In a survey reported in the Carolina Cooperator, it was found that 15% of all ladies tint their hair, 22% wear false eyelashes, 38% wear wigs, 80% wear rouge, 93% wear nail polish, and 98% wear eyeshadows. But 100% of the ladies surveyed were in favor of a resolution condemning any kind of false packaging. Now, there have always been a few dissidents among the females of all time, of course. If we had lived in the 1920s, we would have read of those that marched against the whole wrongness of not being able to vote. And even 40 years before that, a lady named Belva Lockwood dramatized the petticoat vote issue by whizzing through the Capitol on a tricycle, if you can envision that. Educational battles for women date back to 1789. That was the first year that Boston let girls go to school. You can believe that. So where do you stand? Who do you listen to? One of the feminist voices is Gloria Steinem, and she shouts, "No one will give you power or equality. We have to take it." Arianna Stassinopoulos has written The Female Woman, and in it she writes, "The truth will make you free, but only if you have a way of ascertaining what the truth is." Every once in a while, we come across a woman who casts her shadow across this earth and receives a great deal of incredible power and authority and clout from God without even asking for it. Such a woman was Esther. She's a remarkable person, just remarkable. Unfortunately, a layer of dust has settled on the book of Esther in our Bibles, and most of us would be very hard-pressed to even give the gist of the book in a few sentences, to say nothing of it chapter by chapter. And I think, even though it's dated as one of the ancients of the Bible, it has an incredibly relevant ring to it for today, especially to those of you ladies who really have lost a sense of direction in knowing how to address the times in which you live. Esther stands as an awfully good model for you to study. The book begins almost like the fairy tale that your mother used to tell you at her knee. It took place in the days of the king. But it isn't a fairy tale. It is an inspired story of a remarkable woman who saved her nation. She stood alone at a crucial time in her life, and as a result, the Jews lived on. The Jews will never forget Esther, even though we may not be very well acquainted with her. To understand this play that is sort of dramatized for us in an almost melodramatic manner, you've got to identify five major characters. So let's do that first. First, there's a king named Ahasuerus, or Xerxes, if you prefer. Ahasuerus was the king of 127 provinces that stretched from India to Ethiopia. His kingdom was the kingdom of the Persians. He was the most significant man in the world. It was in the days of the laws of the Medes and the Persians. And as you know, that means there was a time at that day of unprecedented dictatorship. What he said was instant law. His word was never questioned. And then on the scene soon comes a woman named Vashti, V-A-S-H-T-I. Vashti is the king's first wife. She's the queen. She's a beautiful woman and is revealed as such in the scriptures, and we'll read of her soon. After Vashti, we meet a man named Haman. Haman is a Jew-hating Persian who is promoted to a place of high influence in the court of the king, and he is a conceited, money-hungry individual who is looking out for Haman and no one else. Then there's another man who is the opposite of Haman. He is a Jew named Mordecai. Now don't miss the names. There's a king named Ahasuerus. There's a queen named Vashti. There's a Persian named Haman. There's a Jew named Mordecai. Mordecai is a man who stands alone as a righteous person who has a very difficult job of rearing his uncle's daughter. Her folks have died. She's orphaned. And her name is literally Hadassah. But her Persian name, and she's our fifth character, is Esther. And it means star. Dazzling or brilliant one. And she's a very beautiful Jewess who is a virgin who becomes the queen of Persia. There's a strong contrast between Esther and Ruth, and we need to understand that. Ruth was a Gentile who married a Jew. Esther was a Jewess who married a Gentile. Ruth was a woman of the field. Esther is a woman of the court, a woman of class and dignity and authority. Both of them are beautiful models of what we would call today Christian women. Now, the date and time of the book of Esther is helpful for us. It comes at the zenith of the Persian Empire. Let me help you with a little bit of history. There was a time when the Jews fell into a captivity under the Babylonians. Now, don't lose your thought here with me on this. And for 70 years, the Babylonians, who were also called the Chaldeans in the Old Testament, ruled over the Jews. The Chaldeans were finally overthrown by the Persians. The Medes and the Persians joined forces and swept the Babylonian Empire off the earth and took charge of the spoil. Part of it were Jews. The Persians were strangely kind toward the Jews, and the king instantly declared they could go back to their land if they wanted to do that. Many of them did. Some went back under Zerubbabel, others went back under Ezra, and a third group went back under Nehemiah, but many of them chose to stay in Persia. And you know, there's not a lot of biblical help on what life was like among those that stayed in Persia until you get to Esther. And in Esther's book, we have the lifestyle of the Jews who remained in Persia under the Persian rule of a king named Xerxes or Ahasuerus. The period of 10 years is covered in the book of Esther, a decade of time in which God preserved the Jews in Persia, thanks to Esther. Let me mention one other thought that you may not know. The name of God is never mentioned in the book of Esther. In fact, it is never once quoted in the New Testament, which causes some Bible scholars to question whether it ought to even be included in the sacred canon in the text. Matthew Henry, however, says, if the name of God is not here, his finger certainly is. You see, behind the scenes is a providence that is at work. And he never gets top billing, he never makes the headlines, but God is at work in and through the lives of Mordecai and Esther, a girl that he loves and he has raised. And as God begins to work in the life of Mordecai and Esther, we see his finger, we see his hands at work, moving in the affairs of human life. That's providence. God at work in the lives of men and women. And he does that in a marvelous way. And through this study, you will see he is still doing that today. Now let's go to the story and take it scene by scene. I think you'll find it not only helpful, but a fascinating story. It moves along a little bit like a Hitchcock story, though not quite as dramatic. There are places where you would be certain that it was that kind of fascination in the writing of the book. So let's take it as it comes. Chapter 1, we have a banquet. The banquet's been called by the king, Ahasuerus, and it goes on for 180 days, according to verse 4, where he displays his riches and the royalty of his kingdom. Those were the days where a king didn't hide out in an Oval Office. He made his popularity known, and he announced his riches, and when he threw a shindig, it was really a shindig. And he would serve all kinds of foods and all sorts of wines and display his military might and do a number on people who came to show them how powerful his kingdom was. And that happens here. He displays his riches and his royal glory. Verse 5 adds, when these days were completed, then the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days. So on the end of 180 days, he has a banquet for 7 days where he invites the people of the capital city of Susa to come. And I take it that it's only men in the gathering. And among these men, he again is showing his glory and his riches. And it says in verse 6, there were fine hangings. Some of you ladies will appreciate the details. Fine white and violet linen were hung by cords, and there were silver rings and marble columns and couches of gold and silver and mosaic pavement and mother of pearl and precious stones and marble. It was a dazzling display of the riches of the Persian rule. And then he got smashed. Verse 8, it says, drinking was done according to the law. In chapter 1, verse 9, says the queen Vashti gave a banquet for the women. And they were having a good time in another part of the court. And then the king, on the seventh day, when his heart was merry with wine, that means he was stoned, that he decided that he would bring in the queen and he would show all of his subjects just how fabulous and beautiful his wife was. And the problem, of course, is that Vashti didn't want to come. And she had no plans to come in and to display her beauty before all these drinking men. And sure as the world, verse 12 says she said no. Now, in those days when you said no, you didn't get away with it. It's different now, but in those days it was like that. The king became angry and his wrath burned within him as he heard the eunuch, he ran back with the word, she said no. And the king heard that and he didn't like that. And so he called the men together to come up with what we ought to be done about a wife that would say no to a husband. For the good old days. Verse 15, according to law, what is to be done with Queen Vashti? Because she did not obey the command of King Ahasuerus, delivered by the eunuchs. What are we going to do with this woman? The guys get their heads together, and verse 19, they say, if it pleases the king. That's the way you began things. When you're going to say something that you knew would please him, you just said that to be nice. If it pleases the king, let a royal edict be issued, and let it be written in the law of Persia and Media, so that it cannot be repealed, that Vashti should come no more into the presence of the king. She's finished. And let the king give her royal position to another who is more worthy than she. Why do they make that kind of rule? Good question. Verse 20. When the king's edict, which he shall make, is heard throughout the kingdom, great as it is, then all women will give honor to their husbands, great and small. We'll legislate submission. We will make it clear that once the queen is put in her place, all the women will get the message. Now, the word pleased the king, verse 21. Obviously, that kind of word would always please the king. And the king did as it was proposed. So they sent letters to all the kingdom saying, this is the way it's going to be. Every man should be the master in his own house and the one who speaks in the language of his own people. That was a great day for men's suffrage. They came through loud and clear. And so now they need a new queen. Okay, the story unfolds in chapter 2 with a beauty contest. And they look for Miss Persia of that era. They got to have a queen so that the king can display her beauty again to those who are his subjects. And the search is on for a woman who will supply the need as Vashti's substitute. Verse 2, let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king, and let the king appoint overseers, and let's do this right. Check out all the kingdoms that is all the provinces, and let's get the most beautiful of the group, and let's put them together, and we'll let the king decide who's going to be the maiden of his choice. Verse 3, I like the verse. It's helpful. Let the king appoint overseers in all the provinces, and they may gather every beautiful young virgin to Susa, the capital, to the harem, into the custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the women, and let their cosmetics be given them. So it goes all the way back to the days of the Bible, right there. Let the young lady who pleases the king be the queen in place of Vashti. Now, you can figure out the story in chapter 2 already. Guess who emerges? Well, Esther. This young, beautiful woman who has been raised by Mordecai is, of course, picked as a potential candidate for Miss Persia in this era. And she comes on the scene, verse 7, as Esther, who was a young lady beautiful of form and face. And when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So here's a knockout of a woman who comes on the scene. And naturally, they would be interested in her as a possibility. And sure enough, that's what happens. The decree was heard, verse 8. Many young ladies were gathered, verse 8. The young women pleased him, and they came in mass. And as you would expect it, verse 17, Esther was chosen as the one the king loved more than all the other women. She found favor and kindness with him more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. It's a great moment. This little Jewess is now promoted to the role of the highest position of a woman in Persia. She's the first lady of Persia. And another banquet, verse 18. They're big on banquets in those days. Another banquet was given, and Esther's banquet, and they made known, and they gave her gifts and all of this bounty, and they sent her off to the harem. And Mordecai kept touch with her to make sure she was okay. He was concerned about her welfare. But in good style, as a story writer, there is a little detail that is dropped on us at the end of chapter 2 that people like you and me would sort of gloss over. It doesn't look like it's very important, because kings were conspired against all the time. But there's an assassination plot against King Ahasuerus. Verse 21, you remember these words now. In those days, while Mordecai was sitting at the king's gates, Bigthan and Teresh, sounds like villains, doesn't it? Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's officials from those who guarded the door, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. But the plot became known to Mordecai. Now here's our Jewish friend who raised Esther. This Jewish statesman who stood alone, he heard that there was a plot against the Persian king, and he told the queen, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name, and when the plot was investigated and found to be so, they were hanged on the gallows. And then that last sentence, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the king's presence, period, end of chapter. And you would get the impression that it's sort of a needless detail. Why does the writer who is giving us a sweeping survey of the life of Esther insert that? You'll see later. Because our God of providence is at work, and he is moving to preserve the people of the Jews as he always has, even without folks at the very time it happened knowing it. Chapter 3 brings on the plot. You sort of feel the music for the melodrama as the villain comes on the scene named Haman. Look at him. After these events, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of a guy whose name I can't pronounce, and advanced him and established his authority over all the princes who were with him. And so here we have a man who is an influential, wealthy officer promoted in the kingdom. And he becomes the king's right-hand man, Haman. And there's one thing that Haman cannot stand, and that is the Jewish people. He's going to do whatever he can to finish them, especially using his recent promotion toward that end. Verse 2, all the king's servants who were at the king's gates bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded. But Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage. Reminds you of Papa Ten Boom, doesn't it? He would not bow down. He would not salute. He would not recognize as authoritative the Nazis of his day. And Mordecai, when he saw Haman pass, stood erect as a good Jew answering to Jehovah. He bowed down to none other but the God of heaven. And Haman witnessed that and hated him for it. And Haman determined in his mind he'll be the first to go. He couldn't stand such insubordination. Verse 5. When Haman saw that Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage to him, he was filled with rage. And he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they told him who the people of Mordecai were. Therefore Haman sought to destroy all of the Jews, the people of Mordecai, who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. And so the time passes. And Haman, on one of those choice moments when he's next to the king and has a chance to talk about some things on his heart, begins to lay on him this plan, except he doesn't tell him everything. It's sort of a deceptive move. Verse 9, if it's pleasing to the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, these people that are in your provinces. I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who carry on the king's business to put into the king's treasuries. He makes a bargain with him, being a wealthy man that he is. The king said, fine, do that. So he took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, and it was pressed into the edict, and it became among the laws of the Medes and the Persians that these people would be finished. What people? Verse 8. There is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces. Their laws are different from those of our people, and they do not observe the king's laws. So it is not in the king's interest to let them remain. Let's get them out of the picture. The king says, fine. Makes sense. Verse 13. Letters were sent. Couriers were released to kill, to destroy, to annihilate all the Jews, young and old, women and children, in one day. And it was dated. The copy of the edict is to be issued as law in every province. And the word was out. Now, when Mordecai gets word of this edict, of course, he's brokenhearted. He grieves. He realizes that Haman is a man you can't trust, and he's in a position of authority. And Mordecai is at a loss to know what to do. And so he wears sackcloth, and he sits in ashes, and he looks the part of a man who is broken and bankrupt as he finds himself at the end of his rope. How can we sustain the Jews, our people? And so he wanders over near the court, and Esther hears of his grief. Verse 8 of chapter 4, he gave him a copy of the text of the edict which had been issued in Susa for their destruction, that he might show Esther and inform her. And so the word got back to Esther that this plot is underway that Haman is pulling off. And so Esther spoke to Hatak and ordered him to reply to Mordecai. Now listen to her. Talk about standing alone. Talk about character. Here is Esther, a Jewess, and she's never told the king that she's a Jewess. Mordecai told her not to. But she says this, all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces, we're in chapter 4, verse 11, they know that for any man or woman who comes to the king, to the inner court, who is not summoned, he has but one law, that he be put to death. You just didn't wander along and visit the king when you pleased. You didn't just trip into his office. You had to be invited, or he had to point to you with his golden scepter. Nevertheless, she said, I haven't been summoned to come to the king for these 30 days. And they related Esther's words to Mordecai. She's saying, what can I do? He hasn't waved in my direction. He hasn't pointed the scepter toward me. He hasn't invited me in. I need to say something, I realize, but how can I do it? Mordecai's response. Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, do not imagine that you in the king's palace can escape any more than all the other Jews. If you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this. Wow, what a statement. Sort of the Patrick Henry of the moment. This is the reason God providentially put you on the throne, Esther. You have the ear of the king like nobody else. Now's the time to speak up. Pastor Martin Niemöller, on October 18, 1945, before his death, announced, "The Nazis first came for the communists, and I didn't speak up because I was not a communist. They came for the Jews, and I did not speak up because I was not a Jew. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a trade unionist. Then they came for the Catholics, and I was a Protestant, so I didn't speak up. And then they came for me. By that time, there was no one to speak up for anyone." Esther, if you don't speak up, there will be no one. Now do it. Reach out. Even though there's a threat on your life, go ahead. Your voice needs to be heard in the throne room of the king. Esther responded, verse 16, "Go assemble all the Jews who were found in Susa." This is a great statement. "And fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maidens will fast in the same way. And thus I will go into the king, which is not according to the law. And if I perish, I perish." That's quite a patriotic statement in itself. "I'm willing to do it." I don't know if you've read Corrie Ten Boom's The Hiding Place. Many of you have, I realize. You may remember the scene where a little Jewish mother comes with her little baby. And she's standing at the door of the Ten Boom home. And she says, "Would you be willing to take a Jewish mother and her baby into your home?" Corrie writes, "Father held the baby close, his white beard brushing its cheek, looking into the little baby's face with eyes as blue and innocent as the baby's. You say we could lose our lives for this child? Ah, I would consider that the greatest honor that could ever come to the Ten Boom family." Friends, there are times in our lives where we make a decision that we have to stand all alone. Some of you are at that place. It's one of the greatest tests of individual courage. It doesn't happen in front of people. It happens alone. Down in your deciding area of life. Down where you have to say, "Hey, if I perish, I perish." If it means the end of a relationship, it's the end of a relationship. There's a principle at stake that's far more important than the people who are involved. And even at the risk of being misunderstood, I stand alone. If I perish, I perish. In the previous message this evening that I preached at 5:30, I looked over verse 17, and I had several women tell me afterwards, "Don't miss verse 17. So Mordecai went away and did as Esther had commanded him." Okay, so I want you to know that that's there. Now, in good, typical woman fashion, Esther is very wise in how she sets this thing up. Now, if it were a man, he would blunder into the throne room and say, "Haman is a fink, kill him," and that'd be the end of us. But not this wise woman. Look at what she does. It came about on the third day. So she waits a while. She's fasted. She's prayed. She put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace in front of the king's room. She's got on a new outfit, and she stands right outside the door, just where the king, as he's messing around in the throne room, can look out and see her. And that's what happens. She's just opposite the entrance to the palace. She's very subtle. This is part of being a woman, and you ladies could do a better job explaining this than I could, but you know how you are, and it's incredible how it gets what you want. It happened when the king saw Esther, the queen, standing in the court. She obtained favor in his sight. I love the way the Bible says stuff like that. She obtained favor in his sight. There's a lot more involved in that. You know it. He looks out there and, you know, he sees her in a neat outfit. And he says, come on in. What are you waiting for? Something like that. And he does the golden scepter number on her, and she sees it, and she comes in, and she touches it, and they go through all that jazz. And the king says to her, what's troubling you? What's on your mind? Now, here again is a perfect chance of how it's different from, it would be a place to blow it. Guys would have just come in like a flood, not her. She's very careful. He says, what's your request? Even to half the kingdom, it will be given you. Esther said, if it please the king, here we go again, may the king and Haman come this day to the banquet that I've prepared for him. I got a banquet. You know, a guy won't turn down a lunch ever. And so the king said, bring Haman quickly that we may do as Esther desires. So the king and Haman come to the banquet that Esther had prepared. This is so good. And the king said, bring Haman. So they brought him, and they drank their wine at the banquet. The king said to Esther, what's your petition? Here they are at the banquet. It shall be granted to you. Esther said, verse 7, my petition and my request is this. If I found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleased the king to grant my petition, do what I request, may the king and Haman come to a banquet which I shall prepare for them tomorrow. It's funny, isn't it? They're already at a banquet, but she says, now the reason we call this banquet was to announce another banquet. And we'll have a banquet tomorrow, especially for somebody important. Now, Haman loved that. Haman was on the inside, the king, the queen, and Haman. Look at the next verse. Haman went out that day glad and pleased of heart. He saw Mordecai at the gate, and Mordecai did his number again. Didn't bow down, and he hated him all the more. And Haman got home. In verse 10, he controlled himself, went into his house. And now he has his wife, Zeresh, come on the scene. Haman recounted to them the glory of his riches and the number of his sons in every instance where the king had magnified him. What a conceited individual. Boy, I was there, and he drops all these names and all this big stuff. And he says, I was right there, and I walked out, and Mordecai wouldn't even bow down to me. Now look at the counsel from Zeresh. His wife, verse 14, said, have a gallows 50 cubits high made, and in the morning hang that dude. That, you know, that's kind of a rough rendering of what verse 14 is saying. Have him hanged on it, and then joyfully go with the king to the banquet. And the advice pleased Haman, and so he had these gallows made 75 feet high. You know how far that is? That's 7.5 stories. You're going to make sure that he, you know, finishes him off. And he's got him, that night he's working on the gallows. Well, he's asleep. Guys are out there building the gallows, but now God goes to work. The king can't sleep. Isn't that good? The king has insomnia. He's laying there, wonder what the banquet's all about, and he reads a paper, and that doesn't help. And so he brings in the chronicles, and he's looking through the chronicles. Verse 2, and he found something written about a guy named Mordecai. I told you to remember it. Way back then, remember those no-name guys that Mordecai said, watch out, he's going to kill the king. So they killed him. And he says, who was that guy that saved my life? And he finds his name, Mordecai. Verse 3, the king says, what honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this? Did anybody ever give him a medal or buy him a new chariot or, you know, they fix him up with something? Did he get any kind of honor from this? No. Nothing has been done for him. So the king said, who is in the court? Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace. He'd been reading all night. And the next morning, Haman comes in, real big deal, got it all planned. The gallows are built. And he says to Haman, king's servant said to him, behold, Haman's standing in the court. And the king says, let him come in. So Haman marches in. Hang on. Haman came in and said to the king, what is it? What is to be done for the man? King said to Haman, what is to be done for the man whom the king desires to honor? And Haman thinks of himself. He says, whom would the king wish to desire to honor more than me? Brother. And Haman said to the king, for the man whom the king desires to honor, let them bring a royal robe which the king has worn, and the horse on which the king has ridden and on whose head a royal crown has been placed. Do it upright. She's thinking of Haman. Let the robe and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble princes, and let them array the man whom the king desires to honor and lead him on horseback through the city square. And the king says, that's good, Haman. Verse 10, take quickly the robes and the horse and put them on Mordecai the Jew. What? Mordecai the Jew? Yeah, you don't understand. You're talking about, no, we're talking about Mordecai. He saved my life. Don't fall short in any of the things that you say. Oh, you know, that is terrible. He lost his appetite. He wasn't interested in the banquet. But he had to go. And so they did it. I want to show you what his wife says later. What a scene. Mordecai returned to the king's gate. Haman hurried home, mourning with his head covered. And Haman recounted to Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends, everything that had happened to him. He poured out his story. His wise men and Zeresh, his wife, said, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish origin, you will not overcome him, but you will surely fall before him. Which, translated from the Persian, means, your days are numbered, baby. That's precisely what is in mind here. And he knew it. It's only a matter of time. And the king and Haman came to drink wine with Esther the queen. And the king said to Esther on the second day as they were at the banquet, what is your petition? And she says, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, if it please the king, let my life be given me as a petition and my people as my request. We have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, to be annihilated. Of course, Haman's sitting right there listening to this whole story. King Ahasuerus asked Queen Esther, who is he? Where is he who would presume to do this? And she looked, I can just see the flash out of her dark eyes as she looks over to Haman and she says, that foe, that enemy, that wicked Haman. There's Haman. He is caught like a rat in a trap. And God has planned this whole, he's choreographed the whole scene so that the king, right on the edge of his seat, hears it's Haman. And in good poetic justice, the last part of verse 9, you've got gallows made? Good. Hang him on it. So they hanged Haman on the gallows which he had prepared for Mordecai, and the king's anger subsided. And the rest of the book is a book of celebration and a feast for the Jews. You know, God does strange things in our lives. He maneuvers and changes and alters and shifts our experiences. And we wonder at the time, why in the world is this a low tide and I expected it to be high tide? Why is it that this was such a difficult summer and it looked like at the beginning it would be a great one, only to realize toward the end the workings of God? William Cowper struggled mightily in his soul, and after its struggle had subsided, he wrote, God moves in a mysterious way his wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps in the sea and rides upon the storm. Ye fearful saints, fresh courage take. The clouds ye so much dread are big with mercy and shall break in blessing on your head. Judge not the Lord by feeble sense, but trusting for his grace, behind a frowning providence, he hides a smiling face. God looked on that whole scene that involved Ahasuerus and Vashti and Haman and Mordecai and Esther. And as they looked up into heaven, they saw the clouds and the frown. As he looked out of heaven, he smiled. He said, that is working exactly as I have arranged it. At the end of the summer, which maybe hasn't been your all-time favorite summer, you might feel that frowning providence is coming down on you hard. if nothing more, you have learned from this study in Esther that truth may be on the scaffold, wrong may be on the throne, but God is sovereign over both. A couple of lessons hang in my head. First is this: providence doesn't require high visibility. God's best moves are not made by shouting. You know, God isn't in the corner at the end of our day saying, "Hey, did you see me today at work?" No. As a matter of fact, as C.S. Lewis puts it so well, it is his silence that is often the most frustrating. He whispers in our pleasures and he shouts in our pain. It takes the Hamans to make us appreciate the Mordecais. Are you learning that the people you have the greatest trouble with, you often need the most? The second truth I learn is the obedience of women doesn't mean low esteem. Esther is a beautiful illustration of submission to God, and yet there were times that she was very decisive and even strong-willed, and God honored it. Her obedience was first to God, and her esteem was upheld. Maybe you don't feel yours is. I got perhaps the most tragic letter I've ever received from a woman. After spilling out this horrible relationship she has with this brutal husband, she closes it, sincerely, desperately awaiting the rapture, death, or insanity, and signed her name. In many ways, that was where Esther could have found herself, cast on the shores, awaiting the mercy and deliverance of God. She said, "If I perish, I perish." I'd like us to bow our heads, please. Just a moment as we close our eyes and commit this new week to God. Behind the fun and enjoyment of the study of a book is a very serious word from God to you and me. He says one thing to one of you and something altogether different to another. If the truth were known, some of you have been involved in perhaps a deceptive ploy to hurt an enemy, to do God's work. And you suddenly realize you're like the Haman of the story. For others of you, you are mistreated and misunderstood like Mordecai. And for you to try to defend yourself would make it even harder and worse. In the day of wife battering and a whole twisting of the truth of submission, my heart goes out to many a woman who wants before God to live his way, but is being abused and hurt. Some of you are here. Some of you hear these words right now. May God give you great mercy and grace as you trust Him to stand with Him. May His character be upheld.
What a drama this has been, our Father. What a story. Best of all, it's true. What a magnificent woman. What a model of commitment, courage, determination. How she set her face like a flint and never, never flinched. How she did the difficult thing, but the right thing. How she even broke with protocol and stepped into the king's presence, knowing that she had your message and a warning for your people that could make a difference should the king determine that. And he did. How faithful you have been to your people and to us as well. Thank you, Father, also for modern-day Esthers, for those dear women who serve you and faithfully make a difference in their homes, in their communities, among Bible studies they teach, in the circle of their friends, with their husbands, and should they be single, with those whose lives are in such need of direction and purpose and definition. Raise up a whole new generation of Esthers, that we might witness the change that takes place because of these great ladies. And not just women alone, but may we have men with hearts like Esther. Courageous, strong-hearted, determined, unwilling to compromise when it comes to risk and doing the right thing. I pray that you will, as a result of this, make a difference in the world in which we live. Times are dark, and the situation seems bleak. Sometimes we admit it even feels hopeless, but never with you. So lift us above the pain and heartache and difficulties of our times, and give us minds that are fixed on you and are encouraged by your word. May our words be so in sync with what you have written that people literally hear the word of God as they witness our lives and hear our testimonies, and listen to our voices. We commit to you our lives and the difference we can make, just as Esther made such a difference in her times. May that be so today. I pray it, Father, passionately, confidently, in the magnificent name of our Savior, Jesus Christ. Amen.
The preceding message, Esther, Beauty and the Best, was copyrighted in 1979, and the sound recording was copyrighted in 2011 by Charles R. Swindoll, Inc. All rights are reserved worldwide.